exactly 10 minutes. I'm not sure you had all those slides ready. Thank you so much, especially since it was a last-minute commitment. So we very much appreciate that. Before opening discussion up to the audience, I'd like to invite the panelists to take a few moments to perhaps respond to each other. We can do that maybe starting with Tim and then moving through the speakers. So.
Great, thank you. Yeah, Larry, you did a great job pinch hitting. That was fantastic. There were two things that you said, Larry, that really struck a chord with me. The first was that water is a network that connects our nation. And the other piece was that communities were listened to first in the Northwest Territories. And I think these two things are really important if we want to. Part of what I was trying to say with citizen accountability is we need to break this conversation out of what is kind of a small, so the stars are aligned, but it's kind of a small solar system, right? It's sort of a policy, expert, science community. We need to break this out into the broader galaxy of our communities and speak directly to our kind of citizens in a way that connects with their values. And I'm not sure that we're doing that to a great extent yet in Canada, but the example you gave of the Northwest Territory strategy where they talk to communities and they listen to them first, I think that's a good one. The other one is the last time we had a kind of national dialogue on water that went to the community level was the National Inquiry of 1984 that people have mentioned, the Pierce Inquiry. You know, we need to do something like that again, I think, to get communities engaged on this issue. So thanks, Larry.
Did you want to respond, or should we move to David?
No, I don't have anything to respond on that point.
Did you want to make
sure
comments?
I will be very happy to supplement, picking up a point that came up in a previous panel. Do you get started in urban or rural areas? And I have a very different answer, I think, from what Karen Baker said. I would say urban areas because we know how to do it. We know how to operate, and there are many fewer conflicts. The really tough trade-offs are between areas where water is a source of your livelihood as well as a service and a way to live. There are, putting some bottling plants and breweries to one. I don't want to put breweries to one side any more than the previous speaker did, but there are very few places where you challenge how people are going to earn their incomes by conserving water in cities, but you do in rural areas, including conflicts with indigenous people who may want to use water in a totally different way. And so I would say get started in cities. The savings are enormous, and they're doable in the near term. And besides, they will save money. I do not accept that we have such a huge infrastructure deficit because those numbers come from trying to replicate what we've done in the past, and that's the wrong way to go.
Thank you, David. Brooks, David Henderson, did you want to?
I'd go along the panel and say, Tim, I'm all for accountability, so I think that's a great message. I would certainly agree with my colleague here that any solution to the water challenges we have, it's a combination of managing demand, using technology to fix or address some of the existing issues. It's combining the public and the private sector. So I would certainly agree that I think there's a role to be played in the demand management or conservation. To me, if you define what is sustainable water, it's certainly a combination of these things. And I like the concept of community. And I think something we can learn from the Aboriginal community is that is, you know, this whole idea that we're all connected. And even in this, you know, this industry, in this room, it's maybe hard to believe that, you know, when you hear some of the views that we are connected, but there is common ground here. And I think that's something we should take away, and hopefully that gets translated into probably the most important thing to come out of these things, and that is some action.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Larry.
And I would pick up on that action theme to say that this panel, I think, is getting to the heart of is the idea that we need to move from vision to action. And the conversation to form the vision and the soft path that David has outlined, you know, has tremendous correspondence with the sorts of values that are reflected in Indigenous society. The technique and the application that needs to be developed and optimized through market forces and entrepreneurship, and finally, the action from our leaders and indeed from our communities to ensure that the vision is fulfilled. And I think if we can create that kind of a system and a dialogue around water, we're well on our way to a solution.
So I think it's what we'll do now is we'd like to open the discussion up to the audience. We won't necessarily take the full half hour because it is a Friday afternoon. We want to give Bob Slater a chance to wrap up. So maybe 15 minutes or so of questions. So I think we've got a couple of microphones, and we'll let the roving mics.
Hi, my name is Lorraine Ederson, and I just want to follow up on the urban versus rural conversation. I'm just a little bit concerned because if, according to what I've heard over the course of these 2 days, that it's mainly in rural areas and on First Nation reservations that we're having a lot of problems with regard to access to clean water and sanitation, I don't know how we can then justify focusing on urban areas, especially given, you know, the state's obligations for non-discrimination and things like that. So I just want to make sure that those considerations are also taken into account when these decisions are being made. Thanks.
Larry or David Brooks?
Any disagreement with that? I don't think there was a dichotomy. It's when you go into the more important, beyond those issues, it's when you start saying, you know, we're not going to allow water for that use. And at the level you're doing, that question never comes up, because you always have to supply clean water for drinking purposes and household purposes. So it's at further stages on that you begin to separate.
Great, thank you. We have a question over here, and any other hands? And one over there, just so that our mics are ready to... Perfect, please.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Suzanne Porterbop. I'm from the POLIS Project on Ecological Governance at UVic. Just wanted to thank you, the panel, and also point to an interesting, I found it interesting that the Aboriginal water rights was left to the new ways of thinking about water. I would have thought it was an interesting choice to put it in the very last panel versus perhaps as a foundation, with all due respect to the organizers. However, now that we're here, I have a question to you, Larry, and I recognize that you're just stepping in at the end. The new ways that we do need to think about water in the context of your presentation is how we, so as settlers, as governments, as academics, can move forward on this Aboriginal water issues. So do you have some concrete suggestions on, for example, I mean, given that this is a national, what the national federal government could do to help us move beyond this disgrace?
Sure. I would probably start by going back to a few observations that David Schindler made last night, where he pointed out, again, quite clearly in the way that he does, that the vast amount of Canada's fresh water comes from the boreal region, which is still the homeland for many Indigenous peoples. Creating opportunities for those nations to manage not just water as it comes out of the tap, but water as it extends across their territories, and to find ways to effectively address issues around the pace and scale of development, which is driving so much of the water, not just quality, but quantity crisis in this country, would be a tremendous step forward. You know, I do a lot of work with the communities in Fort Chipewyan downstream from the oil sands, and they have no control over what's happening upstream of their community, which is having such dramatic effects on themselves and their environment. I think if they were in charge of how water allocations were to be made, the industry would be regulated somewhat differently, and on down the Mackenzie we would go. I think if we take that type of an approach and look at how downstream communities and upstream communities relate to each other in a respectful way, and how users, again, relate to each other in respectful ways, and create legal instruments which enforce those relations, I think we're on our way.
We had a woman over here in this area who had her hand up, and can I just see some other hands so that we can get our mics over here? Okay.
I'm in, actually.
Oh,
actually,
you both did. Share.
Yeah, we can share the mic. Wesley Gee from Canadian Business for Social Responsibility. I think it's great to have someone like David Henderson here kind of representing the doing side, you know, from the investment side, in addition to all the other great people that have been here. I've got a question for anyone who wishes to answer it, but I'm just wondering, to what degree you feel it's important that we look at small-scale, localized approaches to water management, and what might be some of the risks and the opportunities associated with taking that kind of smaller-scale approach as opposed to the robust systems that can exist in a lot of areas.
I'll answer that question and sort of tie it into some of the question, rural versus urban. There's some very interesting technology being developed around the remote monitoring and controlling of systems. One of the challenges in managing clean water is it's actually a pretty sophisticated process now to clean up the water to drinking water levels. And some of the challenges we've had is as you move these systems into rural areas where you don't have the expertise and the technical training and all the rest of that, you know, we've had situations where we have these great, you know, technology and systems put in, but then you don't have the people to operate them. So there's a great tie-in happening now around the remote monitoring capabilities, so the ability to actually deploy technology to understand what's going on in your wetland or in your environment in real time. And then that's being enabled by things like the internet and wireless technologies that allow you to bring that data together. And then you can run the analytics and all sorts of stuff, which allow you to operate these systems in a much more automated and manual way. And I think that is going to be pretty exciting for rural water development, because this means you can transfer some of the sophisticated technology into these areas, which could be very, which is going to help supply that clean water. And at the same time, you know, again, you're enabling sort of that next level of jobs and economic opportunity, and that can be tied back into that community as well. So I think there is a real opportunity on downsizing systems. I firmly believe, and my observation is, and I think David said this just a minute ago, is I don't think the centralized water system is going to survive the next 100 years. I think we're going to move to distributed systems. We're already starting to see it, in particular on the wastewater side. That's where it's going to start first in a heavy way, because there's a lot of value in wastewater. We can actually extract minerals and energy and chemicals and all sorts of stuff that we used to just you know, try and treat and discharge in the environment. We can actually recycle that. And so I think you're going to see distributed small systems. You're going to see the actual water, treatment of that system move very close to the actual use of that system, and especially when we start to see the enabling of water recycling reuse, which I think is going to be one of the more bigger opportunities, in particular in North America, in the next 20, 30 years.
I would only add to that, I would agree to exactly this, would have said exactly the same things, that there are significant diseconomies of scale, and I would add the vulnerability of most water systems is in the piping. So the shorter the length of the pipe, the better off you are. And this was demonstrated enormously strongly in Hurricane Mitch, when the water treatment plants were still there, the water supply plant was there. What wasn't there were the pipes.
What we'll do now, I think, is I'll just take any remaining questions. We'll go through them and give the speakers a chance to respond. So there's a woman there next to our last, and then over here, and then at the back. So three more questions, I believe.
I'll be quick.
That's okay. We'll take them. I don't want to cut you off, but we'll take them in turn, and then the panelists will respond once we've heard from all three. So please go ahead.
Okay. Yes. David Henderson, you mentioned water towers and how technology really improved things there. And that's something I kind of know about, but I'm definitely not an engineer. And so I kind of have a technical question, and I have a bit of a broader question. My technical question is, we tend to conceive water, and we talk about water quality, and we talk about levels of water, but water temperature is also pretty important for ecosystems. So if water is being used in these towers to cool buildings, and conceivably it would heat up in that process, what then happens to that heated water? Does it go back into the ecosystem? So that's my technical question. And then my less technical question is, I understand technology and engineering, there's a lot of science involved, but do you ever work side by side with environmental organizations or anyone else to have a more interdisciplinary approach, since we've been talking a lot about integration today?
So I'll ask you to just hold your thoughts on that, and we'll go to this question here in the front. Yes?
Hi, my name is Jessie Kettler. I'm a student here at McGill University in the IWRM Master's Program. My question is directed toward Larry. If you visit the INAC website, the Indian and Northern Affairs Canada website, you'll see that they've been working on a new law legislation for water and First Nations communities. They have a discussion paper that you can read on their website where they say that the government stance or their preferred option is a combination of provincial laws basically made into a federal law. But if you read a previous report from the expert panel, it says that that is the least preferred option by the First Nations. I wanted to know what your opinion is on this.
Thank you. And our last question, I believe. Yes.
Hi, my name is Simon. I'm a student from political science. My question is about the political attractiveness of the South Path. If you go for supply management, it involves infrastructure, creation of jobs, demand management, again, creation of jobs through new technology, research and development, while the soft path involves changing our behavior. So what are the incentives? Perhaps a big and famous green tax that would destroy a political career, or regulations and pricing. So as you said yourself, soft path seems to give the solutions more efficient, but in the long term, which is kind of the opposite mechanism for politics. So what do you think are the possible solutions to go beyond that, which was your opening conclusion?
Great, thank you. So we have a question for three of our panelists. So what that means is, Tim, I'll ask you to have the closing word after each of the three have responded, I'm sure, because you were our first speaker, so we'll give you the last word. So David Henderson, Larry, David Brooks, and then Tim.
So I'm going to address the question about cooling towers. So to answer your technical question, it actually comes down to the system itself. So under a closed-loop system, which would be the systems that are used in buildings, my answer would probably be no, because that water is actually discharged into the wastewater system, so it's going to be treated through the wastewater system process. So I don't think you have that challenge. The second question... Or the second part of your question was more around. Absolutely. I mean, I've become a big believer in. I think all views are important. I think if we're going to solve this problem, we need to have all the stakeholders at the table. You know, one of the things you'll see, we're launching the Ontario Opportunity Report next week. And, you know, one of the key messages in there is we got to bring everyone to the table and we got to find the common ground. There is going to be things that we're going to have disagreements on. There's going to be differences of opinions on certain areas. But I think we all have to extend a little bit of the olive branch. You know, the private sector where I'm from has to do it. The environmental sector has to do it. The government has to do it. But I think, like I said earlier, with where we are today, because of the amazing opportunity around the green economy, to create jobs. I think there's political capital to get this stuff done. I think the awareness, things like the internet, making people and the general public more aware of these issues, I think can help bring things along. And then I'm just a big believer in a combination of, you know, conservation and sustainable water practices with technology. We can go a long way to solve these problems, but there is no silver bullet. So therefore, if there's no silver bullet, there can't be one answer.
It sort of goes to the heart of some of the issues in the relationship between Aboriginal people and the federal government. The biggest, I guess, challenge at a local level is capacity. And INAC has done, I think, an appalling job of ensuring that communities have the capacity to address water quality and general infrastructure issues within many communities. So it's an easy fix for them to invoke Section 88 and turn to the provinces and say, your problem. But this doesn't get to the root of the issue. The root of the issue is that these communities are in the process of becoming self-determining in accordance with federal policy statements on self-government. So passing the buck between the two levels of the Crown doesn't actually deal with capacity. And it makes, in my view, a mockery of the idea of subsidiarity, that, as Karen mentioned in her talk this morning, that decisions should be made at the level most appropriate to address the concerns. That, of course, should be distinguished from downloading, where you're left with all the problems and none of the means with which to address them. So I don't think much of that approach, and I think that there would be a better way, but it would have to take some significant investment in order to create the capacity to manage these systems and manage them well.
That's a very good question, and it really lies within that last statement about making water soft powers politically attractive, which is the least well-developed. The analysis is, the vision is easy. It's been around for literally millennia. The analysis is much, much younger, but still well in hand. The conversion to a political platform is still going. So, but it's a three-part answer. First of all, there are almost no conflicts between demand management and soft pass. Anything you would do for demand management, we're on the same level with, there's nothing that Steve Renzetti said that I would disagree with. You need those prices, you need the price incentives. That's the first level. Second, there are a lot of things that begin to go beyond the price thing, strategy. Because you want more environment, whether you want more water to be left in situ, whether for recreational purposes, that's a fairly easy one, but for spiritual, other reasons, you want the water left there. And those are trade-offs that are within the political, the ability to politics to handle, at least on a local level at the moment. But you do get another step toward sustainable development. The third step is much deeper. I guess it was Ralph Pentland that said the term sustainable development has been misused, been overused. I couldn't agree more, but I'm not willing to let it go. I think it still has enormous value, and at some point, sustainable development is dramatically in conflict with increasing population and increasing economic wealth. And that's when the soft path really comes, soft path writ large, because you have to make major trade-offs and accept the fact that we're not going to keep getting richer, not getting richer in conventional economic dollar terms, which is also, by the way, for those of you who've heard Dr. Doom speak, this isn't Darth Vader, it's Bill Reese at UBC, who keeps saying, you know, how can you do this? What good does conservation do if people save money and then go out and spend it again? Then it's, what the answer is, less money. But that's a longer term. That's well down the road before we get to that kind of platform.
And last but not least, Morris.
Maybe just with a little addendum, David, I think there probably are jobs involved in the soft path approach. In green infrastructure, there's green plumbers, there's designers, there's the new technologies associated with recycling. I certainly think you can make a pitch that soft path is an integral part of a green economy. So I think you do have a political angle there. It just needs some development to figure out what those jobs are and the economic connections. I guess it's an enviable task to try and tie together some of the things that have been discussed today. But one of the things I come back to is what Doug Miller said yesterday about water being kind of a background issue. Because what I sense is that it matters to people, right? It's considered our most important natural resource, but that's when they've been asked directly about water. But it's not yet a top-of-mind concern. It's sort of a subsurface concern. So somehow we have to find ways to ensure that public citizens and communities start to recognize water as a top-line concern. And it probably means connecting it with other top-of-mind concerns like the economy, like energy, like health. I think if we can connect with those issues and then connect with the direct values of individuals, we could see this become more of a top-of-mind concern for citizens in Canada, but then also our politicians, because our politicians look at these polls too, and they realize water is far down the list when it comes to the issues. Economy's at the top, health is up there, climate change was up there for a while but dipped again, and water is somewhere down there until it goes up a little bit, and until I think our politicians and governments start hearing it from their constituents, I'm not sure that we'll make the progress that we're all looking to make. So I think the conversation needs to go outside of this room and then into our communities and beyond.
Well, I think that's a perfect note to wrap up on. I'd like to thank our panelists for a very substantive and stimulating discussion. Not an easy feat on a Friday afternoon after a very full conference. So thank you very much to our panelists. And I'd like to involve Robert Slater to do the official wrap-up for the conference. Bob Slater.